You're listening to the Cycling Podcast at the 2026 Vuelta a España, on the ground and on the road, from Monaco to Granada.
Buenas tardes, Lionel. Bernie.
Hello, hello.
Well, that was a shocker, Lionel. The great reveal there. I didn't tease it yesterday. I think most days I say who's coming, but it was though you've sort of jumped. I don't know. You've emerged from behind a silk curtain.
The secret act at Glastonbury, you know, when they put TBC on the bill, and then I don't know, Radiohead come out or something. I mean, I'm not saying I'm the audio.
Comparing, I was about
podcasting.
To say comparing yourself to Radiohead. There we go. We've started well. Well, Lionel, this is the first in our world's coverage, because I think I have only had IRL guests so far. I learned recently that this is a well-recognized acronym. Favored
in real life.
Yeah, favored used by Gen Z. We're going to talk more about Gen Z terms coined by Gen Z, possibly later on, but I haven't forewarned you about that. Yes, but Lionel,
that's right in my wheelhouse, that, Daniel.
Yeah, there you go.
If you've got some boomer phrases, I'm all over it.
There you go. There you go. We're talking satellite riders, P1,
P2. Oh, no.
Here we go. Yeah. That's for part three, Lionel. That's for part three.
Okay. I'm warmed up already.
There you go. Well, Lionel, you are not sitting opposite me. I suppose people would rather hear where I'm sitting than about what your house that they've heard about many times, or your shed, your second shed, looks like. So you may be able to hear, Lionel, you may be able to recognise the sound effects of a typical sort of, I don't want to say humble because that sounds slightly patronizing, but a hearty sort of roadside Spanish taverna or adjacent to the finish line bar in this case. And the stage finished about an hour ago, and we're going to recap what was a very exciting stage, aren't we? A very exciting stage, I'm going to spoil it straight away, won by Wout van Aert. Finally, the drought at this Vuelta a España, you hadn't won up until this point, is over. But it took some excellent tactics and a lot of watts, I would suggest. But we'll get into all that. But first of all, Lionel, how the devil are you?
Well, very good, Daniel. Yeah, I had a lovely holiday in Ibiza. We had the storm, the hailstorm that eventually hit the Vuelta. It kind of moved across the Balearics the day and night before and moved up to, where were you? You were still in France at that point, weren't you? I don't know where you were sheltering specifically, but that storm was pretty... Well, it was the one thing that I thought might derail Tadej Pogacar. I've obviously been watching the Vuelta. It's so far a race of two halves, isn't it? Pog dominant and then Pogless. And, I mean, we could talk a little bit about my thoughts on Enric Mas a bit later. But you mentioned the Wout drought. He's been looking good. He's been looking very good in that dark green jersey. And, I mean, today they really pulled off a number, Visma Lisa bike. It took me right back to the early days of this year's Tour de France, the stage into Foix, stage four, I think it was, when Mads Pedersen and Quinn Simmons, and I think it was Matthias Vacek of Lidl Trek, all got into a similarly sized break as the one we saw today, a little bit smaller. And there was a real sense of inevitability that Mads Pedersen was going to win the stage. Today, Visma Lisa bike kind of made order from chaos, didn't they? If Wout van Aert hadn't finished it off in the way that he did, I think I'd be scratching my head wondering how on earth they managed to lose it, because him and Matt Brennan particularly, they went all out and their moves were obvious and telegraphed, and everyone tried to mark when they could, but it made for a really thrilling race, especially from that final climb and then down the other side and on the run into the finish, a really kind of absorbing 50, 60 kilometres of racing. Grand Tour racing at its best, really, and I think one of those stages that fits into the category of a classic within a stage race.
Indeed, Lionel. And another stage that's going to give ammunition to the anti-Pogacar lobby who have been crying from the rooftops rooftops that this Vuelta a España has been better since he's left, but we won't get into that. We won't wade into that debate just yet. Lionel, as always in the podcast, we're going to go back to this morning. We were in Andalusia. We're going to be in Andalusia. I keep saying this for the rest of the race. This morning, specifically, we're on the Costa Tropical, and we're in a place called Almuñécar, which is the home, as I mentioned yesterday, of Carlos Rodriguez of Net Company Ineos. Of course, Rodriguez himself was once, you could say, the great white hope of Spanish cycling. Talking of great white hopes, yesterday we had victory in the stage to Cala Alto for Jakob Omrzel of Slovenia, the new Tadej Pogacar. Everyone was saying yesterday, of course, we were sort of guiltily mentioning Tadej Pogacar in yesterday's podcast because I didn't really want to saddle him with that. But what we also had, Lionel, after yesterday's stage was new intrigue in the white jersey competition, because Oscar Only suddenly only led by 30 seconds from Jakob Omrzel, and Only, of course, also had that crash early on yesterday's stage. We didn't hear from him in last night's podcast, and we wondered how much he'd been affected by that crash yesterday. To find out a bit more about that, I summoned him to the mix zone this morning, and I also summoned Jakob Omrzel to set up what we think is going to be a pretty interesting battle between those two in the white jersey of the coming days. So here they are, Jakob Omrzel talking to me this morning, and then Oscar Only. Crazy 24 hours. I mean, congratulations first, but how did you sleep last night?
Yeah, surprisingly, I slept really well. I slept normal like every day, and I was really trying to get my mind somewhere else and trying to calm down and fall asleep.
If you'd imagined winning a stage in the Vuelta, was it different to how you imagined it, everything that happened afterwards, or was it more or less as you would have expected?
No, I think this was the first plan that how would I expect it. And yeah, for me, it is something incredible and almost unbelievable. But in the meantime, I worked hard, and yeah, I was almost dreaming of it.
And now, obviously, the race changes a bit for you. How are you thinking about the challenge now? You're going to have to stay with the GC group in tomorrow, for example, in the Pandera. How are you thinking about that challenge?
Yeah, exactly. Now I shifted, so for sure, yeah. I achieved my stage win, but now we are not stopping because we are close, and I think by the data I can be with them.
The data suggests you can be with them?
Yeah, I mean, just like overall, for sure, yeah, I cannot be with top three guys or top four, but I think with others, I think I'm pretty compatible, and yeah, I will try my best, but I'm not saying anything. It could happen anything. Here it's hot, and yeah, we go day by day.
And is this the best level you've ever had?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I'm racing on the best level at the moment, and yeah, for sure, I've never been that fast.
Well, Oscar, first of all, tell me what the effects of the crash were yesterday.
Yeah, not too bad. Now my hips are equal. I've got cuts on both sides, so now I feel okay. Just kind of slid, so nothing too bad.
Difficult to gauge, I suppose, but how much do you sense that it affected you on the last climb yesterday?
Yeah, like I didn't feel bad, and I didn't feel like it was affecting me, but I just couldn't really go that deep, and I think maybe I just wasn't on the best day anyway, and yeah, just had to kind of limit my losses, and Jack was really good on that flatter section to really, yeah, keep the gap in check.
Does it change the way you're going to approach the race now? Are you thinking, well, basing your race on Omrzel, or are you still looking ahead rather than behind?
No, I'm still looking ahead. I think, with all due respect to Omrzel, obviously getting time in the break is, you know, he obviously had a big day yesterday. And if you just look on the climbing performances so far in the race, then yeah, I'm trying to look ahead around like Carapaz, and obviously I'd love to be on the podium, but that's now quite a gap, but there's still a long way to go, and a lot can change, so yeah, still got to stay positive and look forward.
If you like YouTube, you'll love YouTube Premium. It's destroying athlete, creator, and YouTube maxer. YouTube Premium enhances how I use YouTube with awesome features like offline downloads, so I can download my favorite training videos before I hit the gym. so no Wi-Fi doesn't turn leg day into loading day. Plus, I get ad-free videos, background play, and so much more. YouTube Premium is like YouTube got some extra gains. Try YouTube Premium for 2 months free at youtube.com/premium.
Hey, what's up, guys? It's Haley Bailey. Okay, I need to tell you about something. I just got YouTube Premium. It's got tons of awesome features like offline downloads, so I can download my favorite videos before I travel and watch them whenever I don't have Wi-Fi. Because we all know airplane Wi-Fi is the worst. I get ad-free, I get background play, and there's like a ton more in there. You should try it. If you like YouTube, you'll love YouTube Premium. So try YouTube Premium for 2 months free at youtube.com/premium. Trial eligibility varies. Terms apply. Cancel anytime. That's a mouthful.
Got stubborn spots, unwanted hair, or uneven skin? The CAPS Laser Center offers advanced solutions. They offer a full range of advanced laser treatments like Halo and Moxie that help reveal smoother, clearer, healthier-looking skin. CAPS is one of the top providers in the world for laser treatments, and their expert team delivers personalized care every step of the way. When you book your first Laser Center appointment, you'll get a $50 CAPS MedSpa gift card. So don't wait. Book today at experiencecaps.com. CAPS, where confidence begins.
El Jamonómetro, de Michele Peracci.
Lionel, it is time. It is time. You don't. You're not the heir to a prosciutto or a gammon or a hamon empire.
Gammon.
unlike Michele Pellacci, but it does fall to you today to meditate on how many hams out of five this stage was worth.
Oh, I definitely four. I mean, no doubt about it, four. And I think on the almost five, as a spectacle, sat on my sofa watching the race, I had kind of low expectations when I saw the riders in the break, because it's kind of all the same faces again. It was a huge break. I think almost a quarter of the peloton got in the break in one way or another once they'd all got across to it. It was over 40 riders, wasn't it? And I thought, oh, this could be a bit sort of transitional stage day. But actually, the racing was really exciting, aggressive. And I think the presence of Matthias Skelmoser in the break, gaining quite a lot of time at one point. It was almost 5 minutes, wasn't it? Skelmoser, very well placed on GC in seventh. And he was, well, looking like he might climb up into the top five, possibly even fourth. And that added another dimension. But really watching how Visma Elisabike would, how they would prevail with their three riders, and they used them all very smartly, but also who else would try something. And my sense was that Visma Elisabike didn't just have strength in numbers, but they also had individual riders, Van Aert and Brennan especially, who had a lot of energy to play with, whereas a lot of the other riders in that break really knew they perhaps had one shot at it. And that was what kind of led to it feeling like a bit of an uneven battle at times, but it was entertaining. So I'll settle on four. I'll settle on four gammons.
I think I would agree with you, Lionel. Four pretty high quality hams, I would suggest, today. At one point I was even thinking possibly maybe if we had a little bit more of a GC battle, and there was a sort of soupçon of a GC battle at one point behind, then I would have been tempted to give it five. But let's try to establish what happened. Not an easy task today, because a lot did happen. Stage 13 of the Vuelta a España, or stage 2 of the Vuelta a Andalucía, was to roll out of Almuñécar on the Costa Tropical, home to Carlos Sugarman Rodriguez, as I've already mentioned. The general classification overnight was led by Enric Mas. Primoz Roglic was second, 1:45 down, and Felix Gall was third, 2:06 behind. Santi Buitrago was in the mountains jersey, Wout van Aert wore the points jersey, and Oscar Onley was still in white. We had two DNFs yesterday that we didn't tell you about. One was my hot tip for the stage win yesterday, Jay Vine, and Arthur Cluckers of Tudor Pro Cycling. We also had a DNS this morning, and that was Alexei Lutsenko of NSN, who fell ill overnight. As discussed yesterday, it was going to be a very abrupt start to today's stage, with the Cat 1 Venta de la Cebada climb pretty much straight out of the gate. The safest money of the Vuelta was a bet on Santi Buitrago and Wout van Aert being the first two riders over the summit, and indeed so it proved, with Van Aert first and Buitrago second. By this point in the day, in the race, for the second day running, Gregor Mühlberger had crashed early on in the stage. Yesterday the fall was innocuous, today it was disastrous for Mühlberger, Gao's best mate and best domestique. Where was he lying on GC? You told me earlier.
He was ninth, I think, wasn't he ninth this morning.
He was soon quitting the race. On the other side of the Venta de la Cebada, finally we had our break with 30 riders opening a narrow enough gap for others to jump across in due course. Eventually it was more like 45 riders off the front, among them the Motown Maestro and Stefan Kung. Bank and remember that for later. Van Aert and Brennan for Visma, Bilbao and Buitrago for Bahrain, Skelmoser for Lidl, who was under 8 minutes down on GC, incidentally. Leknesen and Korn for Uno X, Laurence and Haig for Net Company, Widar of Lotto, Elosegi of Kern, another name to remember for later. Movistar and Mass were happy, but the group was too big for sustainable cohesion, and so the counter and rebel moves commenced. Eventually we had 10 in the Fuga della Fuga, including Vincenzo Albanese of EF, who went over the next classified climb first, and Guillaume Martin and Krohn, who followed him over the top. Two previous stage winners in this Vuelta, Brennan and Leknesen, had also made this split, like Berthet, Bizio, Kraps, Vermaaka and Rodriguez. Christian of Astana, that was another Andalusian, like Sugarman. Just past the halfway point of the stage, the temperature was edging 40 degrees and the day was turning torrid for several riders. Pavel Sivakov had pulled out, exhausted by the heat. Francesco Buzzato and Senta Sentiens followed him out of the Vuelta. Axel Laurence and David de la Cruz both suffered heavy falls and needed medical attention. When Brennan took the bonus sprint with 47 kilometres to grow, the group of 10 looked well set to stay clear. But then suddenly the gap started to come down, with Will Barton and Stefan Kung pulling for Team Tude and Team Larry, followed by Visma deciding they wanted to reunite Brennan and Van Aert. Contact was made, at least by some of the riders, on the last classified climb of the day, the second cat, Puerto de Granada, which Kevin Vermaaka summited in the lead. Back in the peloton, Skelmoser's 4-plus-minute advantage was causing ripples of anxiety. EF started to ride to protect Carapaz's fourth place overall. Then Net Company began to defend Only's fifth, and Dick Adlon, Gao's third. Down the other side of the Puerto de Granada, a new group was now riding away. All eyes were on Brennan and Van Aert, and they needed eyes everywhere and watts to burn to extinguish the constant attacks. Finally, 3 kilometres from the line, Van Aert himself decided attack was the best form of defence. He powered clear with Valentin Paris-Peintre on his wheel, a bantamweight following a super heavyweight. VPP relayed WVA at first, but then let the bigger man lead out the sprint and ultimately take Visma's fourth stage of the race. The unplayable Brennan, of course, sprinted to third place, while 3 minutes down the road, the GC men had sped up and cut down Skelmoser's gains, as we will find out when we give the standings in just a second. Cor blimey, what a day.
Very good, Daniel. I mean, I was listening back to that and I could pinpoint. No, pretty good. I was pinpointing the moment when I went to the kitchen for some snacks. And as you finish that summary there, I'm wondering whether 4 gammons is enough. Maybe 4 gammons with a fried egg on top, or perhaps even a slice of pineapple. Dear. I don't know how you feel about that.
in the first week, we visited some locations where you probably could have ordered gammon with egg on top. Anyway, less said about that, probably the better. Lionel, I'll give the top 10 on the stage. Wout van Aert, of course, won the stage. Time 4 hours 34 minutes. Valentin Paris-Peintre, as discussed, was second. Matthew Brennan, third. He ended up coming in 24 seconds down. Vidar was fourth, also 24 seconds down in that group. Also Albanese, Finn Fischer-Black, Kevin Vermaaka. A few seconds further down, Leo Bizio of Decathlon. Then we had Simon Dalby of X Mobility. Then Filippo Zana. All of these chaps in the break, and in fact, Lionel, I have to go way down to find someone who's not designated as having been in the break. If we're only to count riders who weren't in the break, the stage was won by Raul García Pierna, because he was the rider who led home the sort of nominal GC group 3 minutes down, and that was quite a small group in the end. Lionel, I was chasing quotes at that point, so I'm not fully aware of how that occurred, how what was it, about 15 riders ended up coming in 30 seconds ahead of another large group. And those riders, well, that was mainly the GC contenders. Did we see that?
Yeah, I don't think
TV?
Anyone missed out there. I mean, didn't see that on the TV, but there was no significant time lost by anyone. So all the GC contenders were in there in that group.
One name, which of course I neglected to mention, was the Motown Maestro, Larry Warbass, who after an excellent performance and a very brave attempt even to make it across to the Van Aert group in the closing kilometres. He ended up 18th today. Of course, we're going to hear from the Motown Maestro multiple times in today's episode, including once in just a couple of minutes' time. On the GC lineup, for such an eventful day, and a day which was sort of consumed, occupied, certainly in the second half, by a lot of teams reacting to things that were happening or they thought might happen on GC, and very little change in the end. I have to go down to ninth place to see any change. Harold Tejada moved up one place, but the first eight riders are as they were in terms of positions. Of course, Skelmose did gain some time, so we've got Mass still leading by 1:45 from Roglic. Third is Felix Gal. Then we've got Carapaz 3:53. Only where he was, Omrazel where he was, and then Skelmose ended up gaining. Well, he finished on the stage. Where did he finish? 24th. Lionel, you're going to have to help me out here. He was 50 seconds behind Wout van Aert, and okay, quite easy. So he gained 2:10 in the end.
And yeah, and that means he's now 5:32 down on GC, when he had been looking at making some significant gains up the GC. I think at his best virtual position, I think he got himself up to fourth, and that was the point where EF started riding as well, wasn't it, behind to just trim that in for Richard Carapaz, who's currently fourth. I wonder whether Skelmose will reflect on that as a good result, given the energy it must have required to be out there all day. He was he was in that break for over 150k, wasn't he? So a lot of pedaling for relatively little gain.
I think we'll hear in a moment from his direct sportif, Maxime Monfort. They were under no illusions, even when on the screen we were seeing that he was sort of moving up towards virtual third place. I think that they were fully aware that at that point the EF Education's net companies, they would sort of swing into action as they did. And 2:10 still a very respectable day, and a good day in the saddle for Skelmose on the King of the Mountains competition. Buitrago, of course, still leads. He did pick up more points today. He now has an 18-point lead. Incidentally, I will mention it now, just in case I forget it later. A couple of listeners asked, why is Wout van Aert going for these points? And I was told, I asked Martin Vinance, the director of Sportivo Visma Lisa, about this morning. He said it simply doesn't cost Wout very much to out-sprint Santi Buitrago on second cat climbs, third cat climbs. And you never know what might happen. Of course, van Aert is second in that competition. I don't think he certainly doesn't wish any ill upon Santi Buitrago, but he may as well secure that second place just in case. In the points competition, of course, Visma hold the first two positions. Van Aert has 224. That looks very secure now. And Brennan is second, 159. In the white jersey competition, as already discussed, no change. Only leads Omrazil by 30 seconds. Lionel, finally, we can hear from some of the chaps who were involved today. I would propose we go first with Matthew Brennan, since he was the closest to what eventually played out with Wout van Aert and Valentin Paipan, and indeed was very instrumental in Wout van Aert's stage win. Then maybe we should hear from the Motown Maestro, Larry, who was in those moves today. And then finally, we will hear about Skelmose's day, what he got, what he hoped to get, what he didn't get from Maxime Monfort, Little Trek Direct Sportif.
To do that work today for him is it's actually sweeter than a win. So, yeah, chapeau to him and well done everyone in the team.
How was that hug you just had with Wout after the finish line?
Special, yeah. You know, he's a super guy and he works super hard. And
he also puts a lot of work in for myself. And that's who he is. He's a superstar, and I'm really, really happy that I could kind of do my bit to get him the victory that he deserves in this race. And that's another one for Team Visma Lisa Bike.
Chapeau, Matthew.
Matthew, did any of those attacks at the end, did they come close to breaking you? It didn't really look like it. It looked like you were always in control.
Yeah, the attacks were hard, but I always knew if there was a guy behind me, it was always going to be his responsibility to close it down and not mine. So, you know, that's what we did. We worked together to get relatively stronger as a team. And, again, there was that breaking point where Wout hit it up the climb. No one from that group could follow properly. So, then the two went off the front and I could manage to sprint behind. But I think the way we played it was pretty solid.
And obviously with you guys in the group, you got multiple options on how to win, or at least one. I mean, did you ever sort of consider alternatives, kind of controlling it more rather than playing that sort of aggressive tactic?
Not really. I think when you don't play it like that, then you play into the competitors' hands, and when the competitors are always on the back foot, that's how you get stronger as a team. You can play your cards a lot better, and the goal today was to go for Wout, and I'm more than happy to kind of support that. And I knew in those stages, okay, Wout's going to hit it really hard at one point, and if I can facilitate that and make that situation even better for him, then that's how we got the success for today.
Well, Larry, unusual setting for a post-race interview. We're sitting on a bench outside your team bus and you've just had a shower. But what a day, what a hot day. But I called it this morning. I said, you, Stefan, in the break. What came after that? You tell me.
Yeah, well, that was the team plan, so that was pretty good. We had Stefan, Will, and myself in the break. But, I mean, I don't think we expected it to be so big, you know. It was like 43 guys. So that made it really challenging. Also, you know, it went really on the climb, so it was like 40 of the strongest guys in the race, you know. So that's not easy. And then, I mean, it was hard because at one point it split. I don't know, maybe after like 60-ish K or something, before this like Padul town. And then it was like we were kind of like, I don't know, it didn't look like anything was going to come. I was worried it wasn't going to come back. So there were some attacks and I just kind of stood and closed the gap myself. So
Stefan was doing a lot of work at that point. And Invisma.
No, this was before that. So, so then I closed this gap, but unfortunately, just after that, like literally as we caught the 10 guys, when a group of the start of this 10 guy move that was away most of the day went there, and I was kind of on the limit from having closed the gap. So then, unfortunately, then it was just attacks, and we were all a bit on the limit. And so it was just stop, go. A couple guys got away. So that was where that, like, 10-man group formed. We missed out. But, my two teammates, they were really, really on the limit. I mean, I was also on the limit, but I felt marginally better than they did, I think. And once Will got a little bit dropped, but then when he came back, he went to the front and started to work with Cairn Pharma. So, they just kept the gap at like around a minute for most of the time. And then Stefan came up to do the last part of the job, brought the group pretty close by the bottom of the climb. And then, it was perfect because like then Army Rai was setting a tempo for Wout van Aert. And honestly, it was perfect until about 2K from the top. And then this Jarno Wieder kid attacked and then the group exploded and I just missed a little bit of the legs to go across when those guys like Wout and Perry Pont and then went across. So, but then we were pretty close over the top. And then we kind of like almost came back. We were like 5 seconds.
You were doing a lot of work as well. We could see you on screen.
Yeah, I was trying. But then honestly, I don't exactly know what happened there because it was like a jumble of guys. And some guys came back, and I think maybe some guys went across, but I'm not 100% sure if guys went across.
I don't think so.
Okay, so I guess no one went across. So I guess we just didn't catch them in the end, but we caught some of the guys. Maybe that group split, that's what happened. And so then we missed, or I missed, the front part. And then the problem was it was super disorganized. So at one point I jumped, but unfortunately no one went with me. And then I was solo for like a couple K in between the groups and then like came back. And then finally it was like not until the last, I don't know, 8K that all the guys who had GC guys got organized. But it's like I don't understand why they didn't get organized before. So yeah, too bad. And then it was a sprint at the end and I didn't have the best sprint legs.
Well, we're not going to go through that again. Oh, I would have liked a result. Come on, Larry. Don't be so hard on yourself.
No, it's okay. Yeah.
Yeah, exhausting day and a hot day as well. You must have been frying out there.
Luckily, I've done a lot of heat training, so I'm ready. But I can tell you the last, like, 10K, oh, my God, it was hot. Like, I mean, it really felt like riding in the sauna. So good thing, you know, I've been almost doing that, so...
Should have been in the press room. It was hell in there as well, Larry, sitting there with our buffet.
It's good. You're getting good training in while you're here.
Maxime, I guess at one point you had ideas that it could be podium position at the end of today.
Well, not really, because to be completely honest, was not the plan to send Skelly in the break. We know that tomorrow is a hard stage as well. But then, okay, the race was a bit crazy, uncontrolled, and Matthias was in a good move, and then he ended there in the downhill. Then, yeah, we were a bit lucky that some guys were pulling in the front, but he did the minimum work, and at the end, yeah, it was the race for the win, and against Visma, against Inuix, was complicated. It took 2:10. He didn't gain any spot on GC, but it's 2:10 shorter and closer to the top five. So yeah, we take it. We just hope it's not too expensive. 2 minutes for tomorrow. We have to take everything with perspective, and the perspective is he was sixth in the tour, spending a lot of energy. It's the first time in his career he will have two Grand Tour. And it's a new experience, and I think if in 10 days we can say he finished 6 in the Tour and 6 or 5 in the Vuelta, he can be proud of it in his young career. So we're going to keep fighting for the GC.
Hey, what's up, guys? It's Hailey Bailey. Okay, I need to tell you about something. I just got YouTube Premium. It's got tons of awesome features like offline downloads, so I can download my favorite videos before I travel and watch them whenever I don't have Wi-Fi. Because we all know airplane Wi-Fi is the worst. I get ad-free, I get background play, and there's like a ton more in there. You should try it. If you like YouTube, you'll love YouTube Premium. Try it now for 2 months free at youtube.com/premium.
If you like YouTube, you'll love YouTube Premium. Hi, I'm Sean Evans from Hot Ones, and I want to tell you about YouTube Premium. It has offline downloads, so you can watch without Wi-Fi. Background play, so you can lock your phone, and it still plays, baby. Oh, and it is completely ad-free. Yes, I said it, ad-free. Try YouTube Premium for 2 months free at youtube.com/premium. Trial eligibility varies. Terms apply. Cancel anytime.
When it comes to plastic surgery, expertise matters, and CAPS sets the standard. Our team includes 7 nationally ranked, board-certified plastic surgeons. From tummy tucks, breast augmentation, and liposuction to facelifts and beyond, every surgical plan is tailored to your body, goals, and recovery timeline. CAPS is trusted for consistent, visible outcomes. Plus, when you book your surgical consultation, you'll receive a $100 CAPS MedSpa gift card. Expert care, exceptional results. Visit experiencecaps.com. CAPS, where confidence begins.
Well, Lionel, a lot to conjure with there. Virtuoso performance, not just from Wout van Aert, but Matthew Brennan as well. At one point, Lionel, I thought they were being a little bit Goldilocks, and I thought maybe they had a vision in their head, not only of, well, wanting to win the stage, but of how they wanted to win the stage. And I thought they sort of wanted their porridge just right at one point, rather than just doing the sort of simple, pragmatic thing. But anyway, they got their porridge in the end.
Do you mean...
Ready, Breck.
keeping it together and letting Brennan win the sprint and go for a fourth win? Or do you think it was more that they were trying to get a victory for Wout van Aert, really, it felt like
that, to me? That's the strong feeling that I've had in this Vuelta a España, and maybe I'm stating the very, very obvious, and everyone else has seen this as well. And maybe, you know, I haven't listened to every Wout van Aert interview, and I haven't listened to every Matthew Brennan interview. But my strong impression has been at this race that they have sort of designated, they had a plan sketched out before the Vuelta, and they had anointed days for certain riders. And there has been some flexibility built into that, but a limited amount of flexibility. And today was very much a Wout van Aert day, and consequently they were going to do whatever it took to make sure that happened. And I think Brennan could have won. I mean, we saw that he had the legs to win. But look, they got the prize they desired in the end.
Yeah, and there's a lot of parallels with the 2024 Vuelta for Wout van Aert, isn't there? He won three stages in that Vuelta 2 years ago. He was miles clear in the points competition at the start of the final week. He was also joint leader, just ahead of Jay Vine on sort of count back, I think it was. They were tied on points in the King of the Mountains competition at that point. And then he crashed with, I think it was about 50k to go, and pulled out of the Vuelta and didn't clinch the green points jersey competition. And this year, clearly, he has got that on his mind. He is already a long way clear of Matthew Brennan, his teammate in the standings for the points competition. And I think, yeah, they set out to get Wout van Aert a stage win, knowing that Brennan was a very, very handy backup if it all came back together. Having said that, I was impressed by how much work and how many efforts Brennan made, both, you know, getting off the front himself, closing gaps. You know, it was real kind of teamwork. And if the plan was to prioritise Wout van Aert today, well, Brennan certainly held up his end of the deal. And they were very, very hard to beat. I think I said earlier on, if somebody else had won that, Valentin Paris-Pantre, for example, and it was, you know, it was close enough to be uncomfortable, that final sprint, wasn't it, Daniel? And Paris-Pantre was sort of level and in the mix until quite late, but didn't have the kind of pure power of Van Aert. But if somehow Van Aert had conspired to sort of lose that one or let it slip away, you would be praising Valentin Paris-Pantre for riding a really quiet, smart, clever finale from that sort of 50k to go point, and making the one move that really mattered for him. And I think everybody else in that group, especially the riders that didn't have teammates, knew that they were up against it. I have to give a bit of credit to Uno X, because they did have two riders in there, at least, didn't they? And they were, I think, the three, actually, because they had Simon Dalby as well. But Andreas Kron and Andreas Leknesund were both very visible too. But it was the Van Aert and Visma show today.
Yeah, I think Valentin Paris-Pantre, I mean, I was really impressed with him committing as much as he did. And I thought he played it perfectly, because Wout van Aert, when they got under the kilometer kite and Valentin Paris-Pantre stopped coming through, then Van Aert could hardly then at that point turn to him and sort of sit up and say, well, I'm not going to, you know, we're both going to lose this. Because Paris-Pantre committing, well, he'd been the first rider effectively who had committed with one of the Visma Lisa bike riders pretty much all day. So he'd given them what they wanted, and he'd given them the opportunity to sprint for victory against him. He's quite a fast rider, quite a surprisingly fast rider, but he played it as well as a 51 kilo or whatever he weighs rider could have in that situation. And yeah, I did fear there might be a danger of them being Nelson Paulist. Obviously thinking back to Duoise d'Or of Londres, was it last year, Lionel, when in a position that looked, well, it looked as though it was impossible to let things slip through their grasp, they did, of course. And had a 51 kilo rider beaten Wout van Aert, I think serious questions would have been asked. But yeah, they did play it beautifully. And you know, you heard me ask Matthew Brennan whether any of those attacks came close to breaking him. I was asking myself, what would it have taken, or how could one of those other riders possibly have thwarted Visma Lease Bike? And I didn't really have an answer. And they didn't have an answer, did they?
No, I mean, there wasn't anybody in there with a finish to really match Van Aert, or, and especially Brennan, who I think probably in a flat-out sprint, I think Brennan would be quicker than Van Aert. I think certainly on the evidence of this welter so far. Who else is there in that group? I mean,
well, I was concerned about Albanese. I mean, Albanese is a borderline, on his best day, he's a borderline bunch sprinter. Not of the quality, not of the speed, not of the pedigree or Palmares of Matthew Brennan. But still, again, if there was a candidate for the Nielsen Paulus role, also same jersey, EF Education First, I thought it was going to be him. But he ended up only coming fifth in the end.
Yeah, and the sort of rider who can finish third in any circumstances, perhaps would have done so had he been in a little group with Van Aert and Paripantra. But it was a really intriguing finish, and capped off an entertaining afternoon's racing, especially as we knew really from a long way out that certainly in that last kilometer that they weren't going to get caught. And so the ball was so squarely in Van Aert's court, as you say, Daniel, that is a good point. I mean, he couldn't very well say to Valentin Paripantra, come on, your turn now, lead me out as well, or go to the front as well and make it easy for me. But both riders played their roles fully, and probably the right result, really, given the amount of legwork that Visma Lisabike had put into it.
Yeah, it was one of those days, Lionel, where I found myself watching things play out and thinking to myself, I would make the worst director sportif in the world, because I would have made all of the wrong decisions today. I thought that was an interesting moment where it was decisive in the end. Who knows what would have happened if the group of 10 that was away 50 kilometres from the finish had stayed away. But the moment when Visma Lisabike sort of pivoted and they decided they were going to chase Brennan back, and again, it worked out for them in the end, and it worked out for Wout van Aert in the end, and again, that seemed to be the outcome they wanted today, not just a stage win, but Wout van Aert stage win. But that seemed like a bit of a gamble at that point, and certainly visually it looked a bit odd. Visma Lisabike chasing a group with Matthew Brennan, who was by far the fastest guy in the front group, and they had a minute, over a minute, that group, maybe even a minute and a half at one point. So they were well gone, I thought. And of course Larry was in there as well, and it reminded me of the stage that Leknesund won early in the race, when, as discussed with Larry at the time, there were a lot of teams with multiple riders in there, but it wasn't quite the right blend of, well, the right partnership for a lot of teams. And that sort of convinced me again today that the 10 up front with Brennan, Guillaume Martin et al. Were very well set to go away and contest the victory. But no.
But from Visma's point of view at that stage, would they not have been more concerned that Uno X had two riders in there, one of whom was Leknesund, and that perhaps Brennan might be a little bit vulnerable?
This is why I'd be a terrible director sportif. Because they were wearing yellow, Visma wearing yellow. I don't go into all of these nuances.
Paying attention enough.
I don't notice all of these nuances, Lionel.
Oh, we've got loads up there. They're all in there.
Yeah,
brilliant.
Exactly.
Brilliant.
Exactly.
pull off and go and get yourself some kind of sandwich.
To tell me that they're not on the same team? Yeah, go on.
Certainly I think it was interesting from that point when the next two big moves went clear, and then even when it kind of started breaking down, very often Van Aert and Brennan were both in it, weren't they, together, and stretching things out together and making sure that they had the numbers up there. And it was real sort of textbook stuff from them. But when you've got riders as strong as Van Aert and Brennan, it does feel a little bit unfair on everybody else. I think that's the point I made in the early days of the Tour de France, when Mads Pedersen was in that break and he had Quinn Simmons working, and really there was no one else in that group that really had a hope of beating him. It was a similar kind of dilemma for everybody else. As I said at the very start, I think Visma Lisabike, they laid much more on the line today than Lidl Trek did, or perhaps had to, on that day of the Tour de France. But also, I thought there was some interesting little teasing moves. I mean, Vermaak was always looking active. Finn Fisher-Black was sort of looking active. There were lots of ways that it could have broken down and slipped away from them, but they were just so alert. Even when Vermaak went away just on his own, I think sort of 15k to go, it was Van Aert who was, you know, on his toes immediately to mark that one. So they weren't going to let it slip out of their grasp.
No, and at times, and look, this speaks to just how good Brennan and Van Aert are, but it did look a little bit like men against boys, and this is something that I think in the Vuelta a España, particularly the second half of the Vuelta a España, you see the gulf in class or quality between riders sort of magnified or increased, extended. You mentioned the Tour de France. So the Tour de France, of course, it's all the best riders in the world at their very best level. But today, I really did feel as though Brennan and Van Aert looked as though they did belong in a different class to some of the riders they were contesting the victory with. And they could pretty much, it looked as though they could sort of, well, it was a bit like PlayStation. They could pretty much do whatever they wanted, marking those moves. And it was very impressive to see.
A lot of young riders in there, though, Daniel. I mean, Jarno Vidar, Finn Fisher-Black, yes. Leo Bissio, even Simon Dalby, I think, is only sort of 23. So there's riders kind of learning their racecraft. And, okay, maybe they will have learned by observing today. Some of them weren't sort of participating. But then there were moves that other riders got in. It's not like they sat and were resigned to their fate. It was a really aggressive, attacking finale. It's just that, you know, the riders who weren't on the level of Van Aert and Brennan, they would have known that they only probably had one move, and they had to think very carefully about when to play that card.
Lionel, I guess the fact that Tadej Pogacar is not here didn't affect today's stage too much. I'm just trying to think and imagine. I'm trying to imagine what the scenario would have been today and how the stage might have played out differently had he still been here. I mean, look, the UAE team, I think, well, since then, partly due to their talisman, their sort of North Star leaving the race, you could say, well, falling apart is putting it too strongly. And look, Jay Vine is obviously not well. Pavel Sivakov suffered today in the heat and he's pulled out. So, you know, it's a very different UAE today than I think it would have been if Pogacar was still here. But just generally, I sort of facetiously referenced in the first part this idea that the racing has been better and more exciting since Pogacar's left. Just your thoughts on that quickly?
Well, I'm not necessarily sure that it's as cut and dried as that. I mean, Pogacar had the race more or less won, didn't he? Until he didn't, of course. And you know, I was kind of torn on this. You don't want to see a rider crashing out and the whole race being turned on its head because of a crash, especially one that was as hard as it was and resulting in broken bones. I mean, that isn't how we want Grand Tours to be decided, for sure. It blew things open very briefly, but I think everybody kind of has allowed Enric Mas to kind of do a sort of... I'm not going to put him in the same bracket as Tadej Pogacar, but he has taken the race by the scruff of the neck and he has made the race lead his own in sort of two, three easy steps. I mean, he went straight out on the front foot the following day. I felt like he was not justifying putting the red jersey on his shoulders, but he wanted to show that it wasn't, you know, he was inheriting it, yes, but that he was worthy of it. And I think on the stage that he won, stage 9, he definitely showed he was worthy. And then, you know, he's put a bit of time into everybody else again. When Felix Gall tried to react and couldn't, and Primoz Roglic just kind of sat tight, I think it does, it's much more open, the GC battle, than it would have been had Pogacar not crashed out. But I think in a way we may well just get through the final week with Enric Mas just proving that he is the best climber left in the race, and you know, he rides his way to Granada and takes the red jersey. I might be wrong, but it hasn't kind of created this free-for-all that I think perhaps people got lulled into thinking might happen once Pogacar was removed from the equation. But it's more interesting in a sense, but I thought there were sort of echoes of Alberto Contador a bit, the way that Mas was climbing in the red jersey the other day, and it looks like he is going to win the race unless Roglic can you know, sort of roll back a year or two and Roglify on some of these uphill finishes, but he doesn't look like he's capable at this point.
Well, hold that thought. We're going to hear from one of his teammates later, who begs to differ, Lionel, who thinks that Primoz Roglic has a switch and he's about to activate, he's about to turn on the killer instinct in maybe in just a few hours from now, shall we say. So anyway, hold on for that. That's coming later. Lionel, I guess it's time, it's around about this time in the episode that usually we pivot to our Encuentro del Día. We're going to preface it today. I'll tell you straight away, it's with a rider who was in the break today, a Kern Pharma rider called Iñigo Elósegui. Kern Pharma, of course, is a team who are threatened with extinction at the end of the year. Now, 2 days ago, if you didn't listen to our podcast, we had a good old friend of the podcast, Fran Reyes, was on the podcast. He's working for Kern Pharma. And Fran talked very emotionally about the plight of this team, this team that's sort of grown out of an under 23 structure that Fran's been associated with for a long time, and it is sort of a band of brothers. We had Pelacci early in the Vuelta talking about Kern Farmismo and the sort of grassroots appeal of this team, and yes, with that looming prospect of the team ending at the end of the season, obviously their riders feel under a good deal of pressure at this Vuelta a España, some more than others, because some of them have contracts already for next year with other teams. But Iñigo Elósegui is a rider in particular with whom Frank goes back a long way to Elosegui's days with the Lizarte team, which grew into Kern Pharma. After that, Elósegui went to Movistar. So he's going to be the subject of the Encuentro del Día. But again, if you didn't listen to the podcast 2 days ago with Fran, here's just a little bit of a taster. And as you can hear in this clip, it's a very emotional issue for Fran as well.
This is a team that has always believed in nurturing their own prospects, in helping their riders become their best. I mean, yesterday we had Iñigo Elósegui attacking, trying to go along the final kilometers and such. And seeing him trying to go for a stage win in La Vuelta in 1966, I could only think of the first time that I spoke with him when he was coming to the team in the winter of 2017. And I was in the Tour of Guangxi, and I was in the hotel, and I was talking to him and on the phone to put together a press release announcing that he was coming, and he was telling me that he was dreaming of sometimes going to Asia because he was huge into Japanese cartoons and manga and this stuff. And then the following year we went together to the under 23 Giro d'Italia, and he had the worst of the times. And all these nights, we had long conversations with him, you know, telling him that it was not all loss, that it was part of his development.
So, Lionel, I duly summoned Iñigo Elósegui to the mix zone this morning to talk about his Vuelta a España. As I said, this was before he got in the break today. Talk about Kern Pharma, Kern Farmismo. Also, on a slightly lighter note, his fascination with all things Japanese. Here is today's Encuentro del Día.
El Encuentro del Día. The meeting of the day.
Encantado. I'm a good friend of Fran Reyes.
Yeah.
And he was on the podcast a couple of days ago, and he was explaining the situation with the team and, you know, this constant effort to find backing for next year. But how are you as a rider? How are you experiencing it at the moment?
It's a difficult moment because I think we have the level to continue as a pro team. I think we are battling in all the stages. We are near the victory, but we can't find a sponsor for the next year. We have win, I think, like 6 or 7 races this year, so we are doing a good year. But even though it's difficult to find, so for us it's not easy to continue performing on a high level without knowing what will be the next year for us, you know. I think this project deserves to continue because it's like for a lot of riders now racing the World Tour, they started here. So I think it's a good thing for everyone for this project to continue.
And Fran talked a lot about the spirit of this team and the heart of this team. You got the heart on your jersey, but you went to Movistar for a few years and you came back. I mean, how would you describe the spirit of this team?
Yeah, this team is special for all of us because, as you say, Fran speaks about the heart of this team. I was with Fran in my under 23 era, and just from that we were like a family. It's something common to say, but here is real because some of my best friends nowadays are from this team and from my ex-teammates when we were under 23. And yeah, when I leave Movistar, I knew that I wanted to be here again, and I think I found my place, and I'm becoming the rider I want to be here.
So what's your personal situation, Inigo? Are you one of the riders who already has an alternative?
Yeah, most of them have an alternative. It's not my case because well, it's difficult. The market is not easy this year, and I'm not a winner. Of course, I'm a worker for my teammates, and I'm really, really happy with that work. But then when you have to find a team, it's really difficult because you have no points, and nowadays teams just want points. I'm happy in the sense that my team really is happy with me, and the proof of it is that I am in the Vuelta a España, even if I'm not winning races. But then for the rest of the team, it's a different situation. They don't see your work, they don't see your level, and if you don't have points, it's not easy to find a team. So nowadays my situation is just without a team for next year. Yeah.
Would you like to go back to the World Tour, I guess, but maybe there were some aspects of the World Tour that didn't suit you as well as Ken Farmer.
Yeah, I think of course for everyone is a dream to be in the World Tour. I was really happy there, but it's true that I didn't know how to. I mean, I was good, but maybe mentally I was not prepared for that, because I felt that I was going down and down mentally and feeling worse and worse. And I think I was just young. I went to the World Tour with big hopes, with thinking I was going to win races and everything. Then you see that's not the case. And mentally I didn't know how to handle it, and that was my problem, I think.
Do you think that's a common problem in the World Tour? A lot of you guys, you win a lot when you're under 23 and you hear a lot of good things from people around you, and then you find out I'm just one of 100. Do you think that's a hard mental battle that a lot of people fight?
Yeah, I think that's the hardest thing, because it's true that a lot of riders handle it properly, but it was not my case. And the problem is that you say that everyone around you says, "Wow, you are the best, you are really good, you are gonna win even in the World Tour," and then you arrive there and it can happen that, but if that doesn't happen mentally, unless in my case you start to suffer, maybe I'm more sensible than others, it can be, and you start to suffer a little bit, and you start to be like, not to hate cycling, but to like it a little bit less and less and less, and you enter in a strange circle that it doesn't has nothing good, you know. So it's difficult to be back to your level, to your motivation, everything. I think it's the big problem nowadays in cycling, that everyone thinks that with 18 years we have to be like superheroes, winners, everything. And man, life is much, much, much longer than 18, 20 years, and it has like a lot of good things coming up for the next years. And now I have learned that, and now I'm happy with my situation, with my level, with everything. But with 20 years, it's not difficult to see it like this.
I'll ask you about one last thing. Well, we'll cross our fingers for your future, but your fascination with Japan. Fran talked to us about that, and I understand you even speak Japanese, you go there as much as possible. Just tell me, give me the background of this fascination.
Yeah, I don't know, a lot of years ago I was fascinated with Asia in general and with Japan in concrete, and I always liked like the sceneries of Japan, the culture, also then the anime, the manga, everything. And then in the COVID era that we didn't have much to do, I started learning a little bit of Japanese, and I traveled twice to Japan, and yeah, at the end it became like I learned Japanese and I could speak with Japanese people and everything.
Basque and Japanese, which would be harder for me to learn?
Well, maybe Basque, really nice language, but so difficult, man.
Thank you. Slush puppy, not the slush puppy, the Mr. Freeze, they used to call those in the UK, Larry.
Popsicle.
Larry, quick one today as we walk to the start in Almuñeca, home of Sugarman, home of Carlos Rodriguez. Satellite riders is the subject of the day after they were significant yesterday. Satellite riders, underrated or overrated? Woke nonsense or the future of cycling? Overrated.
Yeah, unless I'm the satellite rider. Unfortunately, we don't have a D2 guy, so can't really help there.
Yeah. Justify.
I think it depends. Sometimes it can be good. I think yesterday was probably beneficial, but I didn't really watch the final. But I guess on a flat finish like that. But you know, like, thing is, a lot of times if it's just like uphill,
yeah,
I mean, they're not going to do that much, you
know? That's always my suspicion, Larry, but I've never revealed this to anyone until now.
But you know, I don't know. Everyone thinks like, ooh, wow, this is a crazy tactic, you know, whatever. But it's like, I mean, if the guy's strong enough to go on the breakaway there, he's probably strong enough to help on the, you know, a while. And then, you know, a lot of times when you see them come back, they help on the climb for like 3 minutes and then they blow up, you know? So I think it just depends where you catch them. Last year, we probably won Tour of the Alps because of a satellite rider, because there was like a valley and then we launched Storer over a climb. Then our other teammate waited in the valley, pulled the whole valley, and then he went again on the next climb. But that's like such a rare scenario.
I'm terrified of you missing the start here.
Don't worry, I already missed the start 2 days ago. So
off you go. Get in that
break.
I
have 3 minutes.
Okay, get in that break. Satellite riders today. Stefan Kung. No. Oh, the other way around.
Exactly.
For me. Thank you. Luc Roberts, Director Sportif Decathlon, CIGEM. Because of the importance of satellite riders, a lot of talk about that always in cycling.
Yeah.
It's questionable how effective it is as a tactic, how necessary it is. I just want to know, yesterday, how specific were you about where Leo should be sort of picked up by Felix, where he should stop?
Yeah, I mean, it was still climbing up from 10K to 8K to go. 8K was the latest moment where we needed Leo to pick up Felix. Yeah, I think there he perhaps could have backed off a bit earlier to pick up Felix. In the end, we had also Gregor there, came back with Carapaz that could help with the tempo there. Luke Tuckwell came back to help Roglic. So, the timing pops not quite ideal from Leo. Maybe a little bit earlier he could have been there, but if that would have made a difference at that point with the gradient still, I'm not sure. So, I think we do what we could with that.
How do you manage it?
Yeah, no. It was we had communication with the second car that was with Leo, and it was basically a clear command: stop now, at this moment. So yeah, and he stopped to a standstill. I think there was a rough guide where he should get to. When we realised, okay, he's really needed now, it was a command there: stop, stand still, wait for Felix. So, if it's still gradually going up, climbing up, if it's climbing up at 3-4%, and you have a rider who's dead in the front, he's not going to be able to contribute a lot, other than give a little bit of slipstream for that might help your lead rider to recover a little bit. Our situation, we had five kilometres there, undulating, where we had guys who could also climb good, who were also had good legs still, Leo and Gregor. And that gave Felix a breather in those 5 kilometres to relax a bit, not have to push on the flat sections, not have to push on the downhills. And we still had that 1 kilometre steep at 3K to go, where Felix could recover a bit, ready to make a big effort again on that one. I mean, the extra riders there can drop a bottle back, just a water to cool off. The temperatures we had yesterday, quite important as well. So.
Well, Lionel, I know this is a subject that you will be delighted to discuss. Satellite riders, that newfangled term in particular. And do you know what? It was only yesterday, really, that I was reminded that this is a bit of a newfangled term, satellite riders. And it really has become part of the common cycling lexicon, I would suggest. Lionel, you will maybe have better context on this than me, but that it struck me yesterday that it's only a term we've started using regularly in the last few years. And look, there was There was talk today on social media about where the term originated from. Indeed, Simon Jackson of Seattle sent me a question on Instagram, direct message, and this is the interactive part of the podcast. He said, where did the term originate from? Who coined it? And what do we think of satellite riders? So, Lionel, without further ado, I'll preface this by saying I think that the chaps at Lantern Rouge started using it regularly a few years ago. I don't know whether anyone else did before them, but, you know, fair play if that's the case.
I've heard it on TV commentary. I don't want to criticise anyone who uses the term satellite riders. I did jump down Graham Wilgos's throat somewhat during the Tour de France when he used the phrase satellite rider. And I said, Graham, satellites go round things. Satellites orbit. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's a nonsense. I mean, it is a nonsense. It's a phrase that doesn't mean what people think it means. It's being used as a term to say you put your teammate up the road as your satellite rider, and then you ride across to them. I guess, is it something to do with the, sort of the imagery of the International Space Station or something? You know, you sort of... You send somebody up into space and then go across to it.
Sort of a probe, some sort of, I mean, it didn't sound maybe as snappy, but some sort of space probe. But there must be a more appropriate image, maybe something away from the whole, you know, domain of space travel.
Yeah.
But look, it's an idea. I think everyone understands. And understands what we mean or other people mean when they talk about satellite rides. But it is interesting when completely new terms enter the pro cycling lexicon. I had a bit of back and forth with Benji at Lantern Rouge overnight, in fact, because I absolutely hate this, and I said it earlier in the podcast, earlier in the Vuelta, the whole P1, P2, P3. I cannot stand that. But we all have our pet peeves, linguistic ones.
Satellite rider is one for me. I wouldn't personally use the term satellite rider. Now people will go back through the whole archive of the cycling podcast and find that I said it once in 2010 or something. Well, we weren't even podcasting, were we? And it's a relatively new phrase. The other one that I don't get is when people say that somebody finishing third in a stage... of a stage race is a podium finish. It's not a podium finish. Third place, second place do not go to the podium to get any kind of prize at stage races. That's a prize for overall classification at the end of a race or a one-day race. So I kind of wince a bit when people
they
say,
do
oh,
go to the podium. They do go to the podium.
Third place.
Podium at the end of a stage race. Yeah.
No. At the end of a stage. I don't mean at the overall classification.
Okay, right.
I mean at the end of a stage. So today, Matt Brennan finished third and Valentin Paripantra finished second, and they did not go to the...
He podiumed, Lionel. He medalled today, Lionel.
Sorry. No, not for me. Not for me, Daniel. Mm. But I think even that's not as irritating as satellite riders to me. Now you've pointed it out. It doesn't say... It doesn't mean what it says, and surely there must be a better way to sort of describe...
Well, that's your homework. Well, that's your homework. I didn't realise this. I didn't realise that it ground your gears. Sometimes it grinds my gears, and that's why it was interesting to talk to a few people, including Larry, Luke Roberts this morning, about how effective they are. And obviously, look, it really depends on circumstances. Yesterday, we saw a few instances where it was pretty effective or important, or the lack of effective implementation of... I'm going to use the term again, Lionel. Cover your ears. The lack of effective implementation meant that time was lost, and I'm referring to Dick Adeline. It was interesting hearing Luke Roberts say that they had told Leo Bisio to stop, but it was still too late. So something must have been kind of lost in communication there. There may have been a bit of a Marc Soler moment, if you remember 2019 Vuelta, the famous occasion where Marc Soler threw a bit of a tantrum on the bike and didn't stop immediately. But as Larry said, my perception is always that their influence... most of the time is exaggerated, and you know they might save someone or gain someone a handful of seconds in the best case scenario. I was trying to think, Lionel, of famous occasions in the last few years when a satellite rider again has been absolutely absolutely decisive. Of course, the one that most people remember will be Simon Yates in the Giro d'Italia last year with Wout van Aert, but that was Wout van Aert. And I still think if you go and look at the gap in the end, I still think that Simon Yates might have won the Giro without Wout van Aert.
Yesterday, I mean, I know you talked about it, but the Mass on that final climb, he had a teammate coming back to him. Remind me who it was. Was it Garcia Pierna yesterday?
It was the last
man standing. And they joined together at the perfect point in the stage, just as the gradient was easing off. So having a teammate to do a bit of work on the slightly flatter section is a bigger gain, I would suggest, than on the steeper sections for Enric Mas. And there was a beautiful bit of symmetry there where it all came together at exactly the right moment. And there's often moments like that in stages, especially mountain stages, where you're kind of punching the air that on their behalf that they've absolutely timed it right. I mean, Wout van Aert's another one, you know, managing to get over the top of a mountain, I remember, in the Tour de France, so that he could help on the valley road in between climbs for somebody. That rings a bell. Can't remember specifically, but I think the phrase satellite rider has to be rethought, I think. Maybe, I don't know, I'm trying to think. It's kind of an advanced force, isn't it? It's an exploratory force. I mean, testing out for your team leader. I mean, the one that's just coming to my mind, which is no more apt than satellite rider, is calling them beef eaters. Beef eaters famously would try the food being prepared for the king back in the sort of medieval days to make sure it wasn't poisoned. I mean, that doesn't work either, but you know what I mean. It's
very good. Yeah.
But maybe, are we going to start calling them the beef eaters? No, I don't think so. So we probably should think of a better phrase. Perhaps we could invent it, or perhaps listeners could suggest one.
Yeah, I definitely think there's something there. And look, sometimes, and Luke Roberts alluded to this, I think that the advantage gained is not in the manner that a lot of people imagine. I think, getting a bit of draft, that can be important. But particularly, and this has become more and more sort of emphasised in recent years, but a satellite rider, having a bottle or having some food, or particularly as Luke Roberts mentioned, and I remember this from Tour de France 2022, 2023 was when this was first really brought home to me, when it was very, very hot, and a lot of the work, the really important work that Tadej Pogacar's domestiques were doing was simply emptying bottles of water over his head. And something as mundane sounding as that can be a hugely important job, a hugely important role, which someone may not be able to carry out unless they go down the road and they sort of tool up for that role, tool up for their captain, their leader arriving from behind. And yeah, I suppose it's also a measure that teams take to avoid redundancy. In a lot of these stages, particularly with climbs early on in stages, riders might be completely redundant or completely useless. And it is a way of giving riders a job a certain importance if they would ordinarily be dropped very early in the stage, if they stayed with the peloton. So anyway, maybe we will see more of that in the days to come. Tomorrow, of course, we've got a big mountain stage. We're still in Andalusia, of course, and we're going to the Sierra de la Pandera. Let's talk about it now, as well as last night's dinner.
La etapa de mañana y asuntos varios. Tomorrow's stage and any other business.
Lionel, last night's dinner was... I'm struggling a little bit. I do struggle a little bit with the food at the Vuelta. I had some alcachofas, which are artichokes. How were they prepared? They were sort of grilled with a kind of tomato sort of relish. That was quite nice to start with. This was in Almeria, a beautiful city. Fran's hometown, incidentally. And then, again, defaulting on my vegetarianism, I had some presa iberica, some pork, as a main course, and it was too fatty, Lionel, for my liking, and I must confess I didn't really enjoy it. And we had a lovely wine again. We had a Humilla, the same wine effectively we've been having for two or three days now, which comes from the southeast of Spain. We hope for better things tonight in Granada, in Albaicin, in the old Muslim part of Granada, which is a beautiful part of that very beautiful city in itself. And of course, we're sort of circling Granada, going through there today. We'll be back there in a few days. The geography of these last 10 days of the Vuelta a España are slightly mind-bending. You would think that given the last half of the race effectively is concentrated in one region, it would be logistically very easy. However, on the contrary, we're going here, there and everywhere in a slightly frustrating fashion. But
yeah,
there you go.
I noticed this. It really is, you know, left and right and up and down, isn't it? A lot of driving around to the start when you consider you're probably not much more than an hour from Granada at any point, almost. Maybe.
No, exactly.
I mean, maybe if it's going round in circles, I was thinking this about satellite riders. Perhaps you can have a satellite rider in a circuit race.
They're all satellite riders.
In the World Championships.
Satellite race.
The World Championships is often a satellite race, yeah.
Indeed. Well, Lionel, we're going to talk briefly about the stage tomorrow. But before we do, earlier in the episode, I mentioned that we would hear, I think I said, we would hear from one of Primoz Roglic's teammates. I'm talking about Scotsman from Edinburgh, young Scotsman riding his first Grand Tour, Callum Thornley. We checked in with him earlier in the race, but this morning I thought I'd find out a little bit more about his role, the role that he's playing for Primoz Roglic, and also whether he is any more adept than us at sort of looking inside the mind, inside the thoughts of Primoz Roglic. So here's Callum Thornley speaking to me this morning.
We've got Primoz standing over there. Tell me what you've learned about Primoz Roglic in the last 10 days.
I would say, on the, what have I learned about him? I'm going to try and give you a good answer here. On the bike, I kind of talked about it last time, but like everything is downplayed and he likes to be relaxed, but he's got this switch, and like when he does turn the switch on, he's like a bit of a killer on the bike, you know. And I think like he's maybe yet to fully engage that switch yet, and I think like potentially, yeah, we're all hoping, and I think in this last week and these coming days he's getting even better and better, and hopefully we're not counting our chickens. Obviously it's still a very difficult situation with the GC, but hopefully in the last week he can come into his own and do something special.
I can't tell you, well, you probably know already, you've heard him give interviews, I can't tell you how difficult it is to how little he gives away, and it's kind of funny, but you always do wonder, do the team know what he's thinking, know what he wants? I don't know. I mean, you tell me.
Yeah, actually, I think there's a lot more clarity than like meets the eye, you know, like it seems as if in the media and stuff, or like he he's hard to kind of read, but I do think when it comes to with the staff and with the riders, he's a normal guy, you know. It's very clear what he wants and with the instructions, and different from how the media perceives him, for sure.
So today, for example, what do you have to do for him? Explain what your role is today.
Yeah, I mean, it's just protecting him as much as possible, keeping the day as easy as possible. So like the last few days, it's been, if we're in the line, Primoz quite likes to sit behind me, I think, because I've got a bit of a bigger shield, and I've got the engine to sit in the wind a little bit and take some more wind so that he can take some more shelter, especially if it's in the gutter and stuff like that. You know, stopping with him when he goes for a pee, making sure he's getting bottles and ice as much as possible. So it's just Primoz is the priority, and having him as fresh as possible coming into the second part of the Vuelta now.
So by the end of the Vuelta here, I'll have strange tan lines and it will be the silhouette of Callum Thornley.
Yeah, that would be great. That would be an honour. Yeah. Cool. Thanks, Daniel. Thanks, man.
So, Lionel, that was interesting from Callum Thornley. Incidentally, he's pretty happy with the way things are going in his first Grand Tour. He's recovering better than he expected, so he's pretty happy at this point. And look, maybe we've underrated Primoz Roglic's team in this Vuelta. Of course, very inexperienced with guys like Thornley, Vandal, and Luke Tuckwell, all young, relatively inexperienced in Grand Tours, but they're coping pretty well at the moment, I would suggest. And tomorrow we go to La Pandera. Last time the Vuelta went there in 2022, the Rogmontada started. He took quite a lot of time back on Remco Evenepoel. He subsequently crashed out of the race, Roglic did, a few days later. However, it's a climb that may suit him, and it's a very tough day, short, sharp, not a metre of flat all day, really. Lionel, what are we going to see, do you think?
Well, I thought that Enric Mas would just ride as he has ridden. I mean, he doesn't need to go out on the attack quite so much now, does he? He can afford to sit tight and let somebody else make the running. If I was Movistar, I'd be fairly confident in Mas at the moment, because we haven't seen an awful lot from Roglic, but maybe that's when Roglic is, you know, at his most dangerous. We're approaching the final week. There are opportunities for him to try and crack Mas, but he's going to have to try and do something soon. So tomorrow, I think, will tell us an awful lot.
Indeed. The Rogmontada starts tomorrow, or not, Lionel. We shall see. I'll be back tomorrow with Pelacci. Pelacci, who promised me that he would do tomorrow's podcast and then informed me a couple of days later he had some other social engagement. And, I called him to order. I said, no, you're not. You're doing the podcast as promised. Anyway, we'll get to the bottom of that yesterday, what he's cancelled for the benefit of the cycling podcast. And that will be tomorrow's podcast. In the meantime, thank you very much, Lionel.
Well, I hope you get a good dinner and not some sort of fatty pork, maybe some lean pork.
Yeah, or maybe, who knows, maybe even some green leaves. There's a rare thing, but yeah, fingers crossed. Until tomorrow, thank you very much for your company, listeners, as always, and we'll be back. Hasta mañana. So,
you know the podcasts you're always forced to listen to?
So, I don't know, is it an hour? About an hour to the finish. We've got the Motown Maestro, Larry, down the road. We know he's always been supported by everyone at home, but he's also got a roadside fan, someone adjacent to the finish line. He's from Traverse City.
Yeah, we've come out all the way from Power Island, where Larry does his summer camp. So, we're ready for the race. Looking forward to it. We've got our M22 flag, so we're, ready to support him.
And introduce yourselves.
Jim Chisholm. My wife Adrienne Chisholm has come along, and my daughter Moira Chisholm.
Hey, Moira.
Yeah.
And, well, you know you have a loose connection with Larry.
Yeah, a friend of mine's brother went to college with him. So, that's how kind of I learned about him, really. And then we've been obviously following cycling for years now. And, it's cool that we've got someone from Travers there.
We'll hopefully see Larry riding through here in a blaze of glory in about an hour. He's still in with the shot, so hopefully. We shall see.
Yeah, we are trying to find a good spot to watch and get the flag out so he'll recognize it, I'm sure. So, yeah.
Thanks a lot. Thanks, guys.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb and Lionel Byrne.
When it comes to plastic surgery, expertise matters, and CAPS sets the standard. Our team includes 7 nationally ranked, board-certified plastic surgeons. From tummy tucks, breast augmentation, and liposuction to facelifts and beyond, every surgical plan is tailored to your body, goals, and recovery timeline. CAPS is trusted for consistent, visible outcomes. Plus, when you book your surgical consultation, you'll receive a $100 CAPS MedSpa gift card. Expert care, exceptional results. Visit experiencecaps.com. CAPS, where confidence begins.
Sierra has all the best active and outdoor brands you need. From athletic stuff, like a full-court pickup game, swish, to athletic-ish stuff, like a half-mile stroll. Get those steps in! And for morning hikes up the mountain trail, good pace, to nighttime ghost stories from the camping chair. What a twist! Whatever level of active, Sierra loves it all. Head to Sierra or Sierra.com for the brands you want at the prices that let you do it all. From athletic to athletic-ish, Sierra's got it.
Andy and Anna here from your new favorite podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
Yes, we are two of the four hosts of the podcast that stuffs fascinating, amazing, weird, mad facts into your ears on a weekly basis. You got any good facts, Andy?
Yes, how about this one? Anteaters have evolved on 12 separate occasions.
Wow.
Mysterious. Wonderful.
The world really wants them to exist. What about this one? When Ronald Reagan left office, he left a note on the White House lawn for the squirrels, warning them to beware of George Bush's dogs.
So there you go. If you like fascinating facts and much more besides, we are No Such Thing as a Fish.